Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there is a man with a gun over there and we want to know what is going on. Thank you for joining me. My name is Leon Pittard, the host of Fair Dinkum Radio, broadcasting from the land down under in Australia. Business groups want government to get out of the way of nuclear power from the 4th of December. We see that there is a push by business. What we need is government to get out of our way. Business SA is pushing for a debate about building a $3 billion micro-reactor known as Prism Power Plant, designed by General Electric and Hitachi. The plant converts used nuclear fuel rods and surplus plutonium into energy. Mr. McBride argued the proposal will pay for itself within 5 years. And this looks to me like this is setting Australia up to be a nuclear dumping station for used spent rods. Well, to talk about this, we want to turn our focus on nuclear power and the fallout. What is the cost? What are the costs to humanity in using uranium and nuclear power? What is the fallout from energy plants like Fukushima? Let's go back even further to DU weapons used in Fallujah. Let's go back even further to Maralinga and the British atomic testing in Australia and other parts of the world. What are the costs to humanity? Well, joining me is Professor Chris Busby. He has a first-class honours in special degree in chemistry and a PhD in chemical physics. He's a member of the Royal Institute of Chemistry, Royal Society of Medicine, the International Society for Environmental Epidemiology, and the Ukraine Committee on the Physicians of Chernobyl. He has been asked to be a referee and a reviewer in the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, and numerous other publications. Since 1997, he has been engaged as an expert witness on the health effects of ionising radiation. He has been retained in several cases that relate to the effects of radioactive pollution on health in several refugee appeals in Kosovo based on DU risk. Also, to our Australian listeners, he has been involved in one case, Brian Murray versus the Ministry of Defence in 2007, an atomic bomb test veteran of Maralinga dealing with kidney cancer from radiation exposure. This also was a successful appeal. He has been involved in this field all of his life, and he joins us now from his mobile phone somewhere in Europe. Dr. Chris Busby, thank you for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Yes, hello.
Well, thank you for your great work that you are doing, and I really am looking forward to our conversation today. And as I opened up our conversation, that business groups want government to get out of the way of nuclear power as we stand here at the moment in Australia. There is legislation, of course, preventing this, but we see groups like General Electric and Hitachi and other transnational corporations really wanting to get involved in this nuclear power industry down here in Australia. But to begin with, Chris, may I call you Chris?
Of course.
To begin with, Chris, let's begin with your personal interest in this. You've been involved really in this industry and, you know, the study of the research ionised radiation for such a long time. Tell us, begin with why you got interested in this and your personal interest as your research has gone along.
I became interested in it because in 1986, when I was living in Wales, there was the Chernobyl accident, and that caused a lot of radiation fallout in Wales, where I was living. And all of the government agencies were saying that there was no problem with radiation. You know, it couldn't cause any harm, and it wouldn't last, and the fallout wouldn't last for very long, and so forth. And at that time, I was just interested in myself, because I'm interested in scientific problems, but to try and figure out whether that was actually the case. And so I stepped into this area of investigating the connection between ionizing radiation and health. And I've never really emerged from that swamp, because it sucked me in. And that's where it all started. Because at the same time, I have to say that there was a court case ongoing about the levels of childhood leukemia close to the radiation, to the nuclear reprocessing plant at Sellafield in the United Kingdom, where there was about a tenfold excess of childhood leukemia relative to the national average. And the explanation for that was not available. That all of the risk agencies that were saying that the effects of Chernobyl would not be measurable, but were also saying that these children who were dying of leukemia around the nuclear plant couldn't possibly be dying as a result of exposure to radiation because the doses were too low. And that seemed to me to be unlikely. It seemed the obvious explanation that since radiation we know causes leukemia, we've known that since Hiroshima, it seemed most likely that radiation from the plant close to where they live was causing their leukemias. But of course everybody was saying that wasn't the case, and there was a big government inquiry. The Black report for Douglas Black said that it couldn't possibly be cause of the leukemia in the children. It all seemed completely insane. So I thought, as a scientist interested in the subject and independent, I would go and have a look, and so I did. And that led me to an enormous amount of research from about the late 1980s onwards to the present day into the health effects of radiation.
Now, you've been around for a long time looking at all of these many different events. One of your most recent press releases is atomic test veteran children and grandchildren affected by father's exposure to internal radiation from uranium and plutonium at the test sites. I wonder if we could go back in time a little to your knowledge and research into the A-bomb tests in Maralinga in Australia in the late 50s and early 60s. I understand that there was many different tests that was taken out around this time, around seven nuclear tests, something like 700 subcritical tests. Could you talk to us a little about your knowledge and research of these tests? Because I did see a report some time ago where I did hear veterans, remaining veterans that were quoted in this report as saying that they would never, ever trust government again after, they were reaping the results of being involved in these tests without disclosure about the risk to their own health. And, basically the people that were there on the ground said that they would never trust government again because government had put them in the position of destroying their own health without full disclosure as to what the results would be. So let's start our conversation by talking about these tests at Maralinga and Christmas Island.
Yes. Well, one of the first people to draw attention to the health effects of fallout was an Australian called Hedley Marston, who was a biochemist and who was concerned about the fallout from the Maralinga test and also from the tests that were done by the British in the Montebello Islands on the west coast of Australia. Now, Marston was a biochemist who was appointed to a committee and to an operation that measured radioactive iodine in the thyroids of sheep, which he did. But also he took it further because he set up a number of testing stations all over the place in Australia and discovered that a very significant amounts of fallout from the Maralinga test and from the Montebello test turned up on the east coast of Australia. There was a lot of fallout in Adelaide. Now, what happened was that he was hounded by the establishment, the British establishment and the Australian establishment, really tried to destroy Marston, although he was quite a tough guy. And I kind of see him in a way, in a sort of odd way, as an earlier version of what I've been doing. Because the more I've looked into the records that there are relating to the fallout from the Australian tests, and of course later from the Christmas Island tests, the more I realized that there was an enormous cover-up of the, first of all, the amount of fallout that actually arrived in areas where there were a lot of people living, and secondly, the actual effects of this fallout on the people who were living there. And in particular, what I discovered was that the main component of the fallout, which is dangerous, and which has been entirely overlooked and in fact, has been almost airbrushed from the record, is the element uranium. Because, of course, these bombs are all made of uranium. And if you look at the fallout measurements that have been published, and there are very, very few of them, we've done a number of court cases. I've done six court cases, tribunal cases in the United Kingdom for test veterans, and all of them have been successful. What I've argued and what we've established as a result of a few pieces, a few documents that have been released to me, and a lot of, and some of them have been actually sent to me from Australian veterans, because they're not available in the United Kingdom, and they were certainly not available in the court cases because the Ministry of Defence wouldn't release them. They said that they were secret. What we've discovered is that there's an enormous amount of uranium in the fallout, and it's the uranium that causes these effects in the veterans, and also and particularly in their children and grandchildren. And we know that the uranium is particularly dangerous because very recent research associated with exposure to uranium in Iraq and in the Balkans, carried out in America partly, in fact, has shown that uranium is dangerous because it binds to DNA, and DNA is the target for radiation effects. That's how radiation works. That's how radiation causes its damaging effects on the genetic structure of the people who were exposed, and also to their children and grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren and so forth. So in a way, what I've done by studying, where I came in studying the children in Fallujah, and we've done three quite big scientific studies, epidemiological studies of Iraq, actually connects with the work that I've been doing for the test veterans. And in both cases, what we're concerned about, what we see as the cause, is uranium. And there's a particular isotope of uranium that is the most dangerous one, which is entirely overlooked and if you like, kept secret, is an isotope that people have not heard of called uranium-234. And that gets increased in concentration in the enriched uranium that gets used in all of these weapons. And so in the fallout, you get an enormous amount of U-234, then that gets inhaled, that comes into the fallout, it's inhaled by the people who've been stationed at the test sites in Maralinga and in Christmas Island, and then their children have an excess risk of congenital malformation, and so do the grandchildren. And this big study that I did, which is recently published a couple of months ago, on the test veterans, children and grandchildren, which we did in 2007, shows that there's a tenfold excess of congenital malformation in the children, and about a ninefold, well, I think it's ninefold and eightfold excess in the grandchildren, and you can be sure that there will be a similar excess in the children. And it's really what's going to happen to people who are exposed to the fallout from nuclear weapons, but also from nuclear power plants, because we know that there have been increases also in cancers in people living close to nuclear power plants. So it all ties together. It's all one big awful story. Mm. And it will certainly apply to you in Australia if you start building nuclear power stations there and reprocessing nuclear waste.
Now, a question that I have, Chris, if you would please help me out here. With uranium in the ground, they extract it out of the ground, then they have to enrich it, right? Could you summarise for us, the process in getting it from the ground, to either an energy plant or a weapon of some description? And, as it is in the ground, if people go and dig the ground with shovels in its natural state, say, are they at risk at that time of being health damaged, or is it the results of the enriching process and the further fallout after that? And my next question after that is the difference really between the contaminated ground and the actual contaminated atmosphere. Is the damage more? Is it greater in the atmosphere as it floats around in the air, or is the greater damage in residual in the actual earth, if you like? So I wonder if you could just summarise for us that process of, to your knowledge, of taking the yellow cake out of the ground, and at what point does it become the most dangerous?
Right. Well, I was in Africa about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I was asked to go there with a group that were financed by the World Council of Churches to talk to some African tribes in Tanzania about the question of the exploitation of their land, their tribal land, for the open cast mining of uranium. There was a big salt pan there, it was an Australian company, I believe, that was going there had applied for permission to the government of Tanzania to go there and dig all this stuff up and take the salt off the top of the salt pan and just dig down to the point where the uranium was. And what I told the people there is roughly what I'd like to tell you now. I said that, you know, a long time ago at the beginning, because I was asked to talk to these African tribesmen in a way that was, I mean, I suppose it's a bit patronizing, but they didn't really understand the issue. So I said, long time ago, you know, God buried the demon uranium deep in the soil where the demon could do no harm. And now men are coming from a foreign country to release the demon for power and money. This demon will destroy your children and will destroy your health. Mm. And that's about it. Because when this uranium is in the ground, uranium being an alpha emitter, the amount of gamma radiation that gets out of the ground is really, really quite small. And that gamma radiation is external radiation and probably will not cause very much harm to people living there. And also the other thing about it is this uranium is widely dispersed in the ground. So in fact the ore has a very small amount of uranium in it, you know, as a proportion of the amount of solid material. So what happens is it gets worse from there. So of course it's obviously not good to live in an area where there is uranium, high level of uranium. I mean, there have been a number of studies of people living in areas where there are higher levels of uranium in the soil, and that also gets into the water supply, and they do have an excess risk, a significant excess risk of cancer. There's no question about that. These studies have been done in the United States, in Louisiana, in areas where there are lots of where there are slightly increased levels of uranium. However, once you start refining it, what you're doing is you're sort of concentrating it. So you're taking the very, very low levels at up to 3%, usually more like 1.5% of uranium in the total solid, and you're increasing it to 100% when you get your yellow cake. So you take it all out, you dissolve it in sulfuric acid, you extract it with various organic solvents, and then you purify it until you get, you know, the yellow uranium oxide. And of course, that's now the pure stuff. So, and that also produces dust. So if you inhale that dust, you get ill. So people working with that dust will get ill. There's no question of that. We have studies of chromosome defects in Namibian uranium miners that show high levels of chromosome defects. And, of course, chromosome defects are associated with all kinds of genetic damage, you know, cancer in the people who've got the defects, and also problems with the children and so forth. And then what happens is that they take that that uranium, which has a very small proportion of the fissile component, the fissile isotope U-235, and they take that out using complex machinery, diffusion machinery, centrifuge machinery, so forth, in these enormous plants like the one at Oak Ridge in America, and they produce U-235 for the bombs. And then they get the very concentrated stuff, the concentrated enriched uranium, and that leaves behind the depleted uranium, which has a very small amount of U-235, and the enriched uranium has a high proportion of U-235. And the high proportion stuff, the enriched uranium, goes to make the bombs. And this is the stuff that was blown up in Maralinga and in Christmas Island. And the depleted uranium gets made into a waste, which is, since about 1992, that waste has been made into weapons and used on the battlefield in Iraq and in the Balkans, certainly, and various test sites where they fire it at tanks and so forth, you know, is practiced. So all of these processes, the whole exposure situation and the health situation, if you like, the health impact situation, gets worse as you go up the chain from the uranium in the ground to the pure uranium, whether it's enriched uranium or depleted uranium. Of course, enriched uranium is much, much more dangerous because it has a lot of this U-234 in it. But depleted uranium also is extremely dangerous because all uranium binds to DNA and all uranium causes genetic damage. And the way it causes it mostly, the exposure route mostly, is by inhalation. So what happens is that when the depleted uranium hits its target, it turns into these nanoparticles, which are so small that they can actually... well, they're inhaled, but they can actually go through the skin into the body. And if you're on a battlefield, on a test site where they've been exploding these nuclear weapons at Christmas Island or Maralinga or Montebello or whatever, and it goes across the whole of Australia and contaminates people by inhalation, produces the same sorts of effect. They all produce the same effect. They cause genetic damage, and the genetic damage feeds through to all increases in all diseases, but particularly noticeable in terms of cancer, leukemia, lymphoma, and of course congenital malformations in children and miscarriages, which is what we also found in our study of the test veterans in England.
Mm. Do we have any knowledge as to the amount of, for a start, we've got the veterans that were involved in Maralinga as, you know, eyewitnesses, they were there observing and become affected by this radiation. But we also have the local Aboriginal people that did apparently receive a payout of around $13.5 million from the Australian government in 1994. Do we have any knowledge of numbers, or are those sort of things, is the numbers of people affected actually sort of hidden? And as you've explained there, a lot of these things surface in the next generation, right? Because it's DNA, chromosome, and cell damage, which really happens with birth defects or defects in the children's children even. It can go on for several generations, right?
That's right. It goes on for, we certainly know from Chernobyl and from results relating to animals, relating to exposed rodents after Chernobyl, that it can continue at least 20 generations. So we're talking about, if you like, I think in the Daily Mirror there was an article by Susie Boniface, and I talked to her, and she said that this was a genetic curse, and I think actually that's probably quite a good way of seeing it. What we don't know is the answer, but we certainly know that it would. That if you take the overall consequence of the fallout, we have studied that, and we can say that without a question, the overall consequence of the fallout in all people. And I'm not talking about the veterans now, because the weapons test fallout came down everywhere. Was in excess of 50 million people, 50 million deaths from cancer. If you take the fallout from 1959 to 1986, I think. And this work was done by the European Committee on Radiation Risk, and it's been published in their report, in their 2003 report and in the 2010 report. As far as the veterans are concerned, I think it's easier to see it in terms of excess risk. And the excess risk in the children, as I said, is in the region of 9 and 10 to tenfold, and also in the grandchildren. Well, I mean, if you take a thousand test veterans, then that would probably give you maybe 2,000 children and 4,000 grandchildren, and so on. And so, if you increase the risk of genetic damage by that amount, I think you're going to see that the ultimate fallout from this is going to be enormous. This is, in fact, this whole business of nuclear and the nuclear contamination of the environment since 1945 is probably the largest public health scandal in the entire human history. It's an enormous problem, and it's very difficult to get it across to governments, because governments are controlled in some way by the nuclear military complex. The point about all of this stuff is it has to do with nuclear weapons.
Mm. Yes, absolutely. And you've got GE and Hitachi telling the Australian government, get out of the way. We want to develop these plants to deal with spent fuel rods. A question on that, Chris, if I may, at this point, with a plant that does want to reprocess spent fuel rods, I mean, are we talking about taking the waste material from another country, putting it into a plant in Australia, and somehow reusing it to create energy? And why would a country want to export its spent fuel rods? Why wouldn't they want to actually deal with them in their own country? Is this just a way of removing waste from a country to another country, where they say, well, look, Australia's got a lot of open land there, we can build a plant and then we can put it out in the bush, right, and bury it or do whatever we want with it? But is that really what it is, this sort of reprocessing of spent fuel rods? Is this just a way of getting rid of the waste but using the energy that's left there before it finally goes into some depository?
Well, the answer to that is that there's very little energy left there. So the only possible explanation for what they're proposing is that they're going to make money by taking spent fuel from another country. I've spent quite a lot of time looking at the proposal, which is like the, if you like, the gold seal proposal for disposing of waste, of nuclear waste, high-level nuclear waste, which is being done in Sweden. I have a lot of connections with Sweden, live in Latvia a lot of the time, and there's a Swedish proposal to produce the ultimate waste repository for these fuel rods under the Baltic Sea at a place called Forsmark. Now, the cost of that is absolutely astronomical. You have to dig down enormous distance under the ground, and then you produce all these tunnels, and you have to put this stuff in copper cylinders, and you have to isolate it, and so forth. And the reason you have to do this is because, first of all, it's extremely hot, and so it has to be cooled or it explodes. And secondly, it actually lasts for millions of years. I mean, the main long-lived component of this stuff is uranium. We're back to the uranium again. And this has a half-life of 4.7 billion years. So what you're doing is you're burying something that has a half-life, an immense half-life, and you have no idea what's going to happen eventually. And, of course, it costs you an awful lot of money. Now, it would obviously be a lot cheaper. You can bet your boots that the Swedes are going to charge an awful lot of money for disposing of this stuff. And anyone else who disposes of it in this safe manner, not that it is safe, but it's safer than just leaving it where it is, because where it is, it might explode, as it did in Kyshtym in Russia in the Soviet Union in 1957, I think, and contaminated 300 square kilometers of land and made it uninhabitable. You have a situation where people will no doubt pay some money to send it off to Australia, where the story is it will be able to produce more energy. Well, it may well be able to produce a small amount of more energy. And the other thing about it is that if you put it into a nuclear reactor which is functioning, it will break down some of the radioisotopes in there and cause them to be more short-lived. So, in other words, it's a sort of reprocessing, I suppose. Mm. Or you could certainly spin it like that. But the reality of it is that you're going to be importing a lot of nuclear waste to Australia, and then the question is, what are you going to do with it? Because certainly, even if you produce a certain amount of energy from the processing of it, you will still be left with this stuff that they're burying in Sweden at an enormous cost, and you will have to have the same problem in Australia to bury it there at enormous cost. Of course, the people who have made the money out of it, the people who are asking the government to change their mind, they will have long gone. They will have taken that money and said thank you very much, and the government, the companies that obtained the money from it will have folded up, and the Australian people will be left to foot the bill for getting rid of it and digging enormous holes in the ground and going through all the processes that the Swedes have had to go through. And in fact, it's not possible to make it safe, because you're talking about geological time spans, and if you're concerned at all, as we should be, about future generations, there's no way in which you can guarantee that it would ever be safe.
Exactly. And, you know, to build a $3 billion micro-reactor, to say that, you know, nuclear nations will pay Australia to take their spent fuel rods, you know, even if you could argue the case, which I don't believe you can from everything that I've seen, you have obviously saying you can't, but even if you argued the case that nuclear power was safe, you know, we have heaps of yellow cake here in Australia. Why would we be wanting to, retake spent fuel rods and do this whole reprocessing of other people's waste when we could get the exact raw material here ourselves and start from scratch? But, I mean, that just, when you look at those arguments, and the other thing is governments are cash-strapped because they've implemented so many socialist policies, they haven't got any more money, so they look at all of these options from the military-industrial complex, which obviously become dependent then on that amount of money coming in via nuclear waste, right? But, Chris, let's turn our attention to Fallujah. This is a crime against humanity. We talked about the military-industrial complex and its use of uranium and nuclear in its warheads. Now, could you talk to our listeners about about the use of uranium in these warheads, apart from an atomic bomb, but used in much smaller type projectiles, but how this uranium is used and the results on the population, such as was experimented with, in my opinion, in Fallujah?
Well, since the mid-90s, I was engaged in examining the health effects of uranium weapons in relation to what was called Gulf War Syndrome. People who fought, soldiers who fought in the 1992 Gulf War, 1991 Gulf War in Iraq, suffered from a whole range of peculiar symptoms that nobody could explain. And all sorts of explanations were forthcoming, but the most logical one and the most likely one was that they were exposed to these nanoparticles from a new weapon which had been used for the first time in any battlefield in that war. And this was depleted uranium. These were the DU penetrators that were used to destroy Saddam Hussein's tanks. And from then on, I wrote various articles about this and came to the conclusion that there were reasons why this uranium caused the effect that it did. And of course, the military and the World Health Organization and the radiological protection people, and of course the military, all of them were saying that it was not possible that these effects would be caused by uranium, because the uranium is very mildly radioactive and the dose was too low. But what they all missed was the fact that uranium binds to DNA, which is what I was saying earlier. And because it binds to DNA, it's an alpha emitter, it causes damage at the exact point in the organism, which is the target for radiation effects. So in 2000, I gave evidence I went to Kosovo and I went to Iraq and I measured uranium in the environment there in both places. And by 2003, I'd given evidence to the World Society, who had been called in to talk about the health effects of uranium. And then I became a member of the UK Military Depleted Uranium Oversight Board. So I had a long, long history of looking at the health effects of uranium. I think 2009, I was approached by a woman at Malak Hamdan, an Iraqi woman, who wanted to see if she could get some real data about the health effects of uranium in Iraq. Because, of course, the problem was that after the various Iraq wars and so on, the whole infrastructure of Iraq was totally in disarray, and it was extremely difficult to know how you could get any real evidence. Any real epidemiological evidence relating to the effects of these weapons. And so I said, well, we can do an epidemiological study similar to ones that I'd already done around nuclear power stations in England and also near the Irish Sea. You just go and do a questionnaire study. You ask people how many people live in the house and how many cancers there have been in the last 5 years and various other questions. And you can turn that into a statistical analysis. And we did that. And we published that, I think, in 2011, the results of that. And what it showed was that there was a massive excess. This was a study of Fallujah. We had contacts in Fallujah, which was a large town east of Baghdad that had been attacked by the United States forces in 2004, and they'd thrown just about every weapon that they had at it. And there was a lot of evidence, and this woman, Malak Hamdan, she had contacts there, who said that there was an enormous amount of evidence that there was an excess risk of congenital disease in children, and there were lots of photographs of these children coming out, and a lot of the Iraqi doctors were screaming and yelling and saying that there's an enormously high level of cancer there. And I talked to other Iraqi doctors too when I was in Iraq, and also ones that had come to Germany and to the United Kingdom to talk about this, but nobody took any of them seriously because there hadn't been a proper study. So we did a proper study, and what we found was that there was, as I said, this enormous excess of cancer, enormous excess of congenital malformation, and interestingly, there was a sex ratio alteration in those children who were born after the United States attack on the city in 2004. So all of these things together pointed to the presence of some genotoxin, some weapon that caused genetic damage. But at that time, of course, we couldn't say it was uranium, although everybody was saying it was uranium, but there was no real evidence that it was uranium that caused this. So what we decided to do then is we got some money, and I have to say that all of this stuff was sort of funded on a shoestring. I mean, World Health Organization studies and United Kingdom Agency studies, they all cost upwards of £30,000-£40,000 for these studies. But we managed to do this for a few thousand pounds that we got from various individuals and organizations. And we looked at the hair of the mothers of children with congenital malformations. So in our first study, we found a whole load of children with congenital malformations. And so what we decided to do was to pick off the mothers of these children that had the worst congenital malformations and ask them to give us hair samples. Now, you can measure uranium in the hair using a sophisticated modern technique, which wasn't, more or less developed after 2000, called inductively coupled plasma mass spectroscopy. And we had some people in Germany that we trusted who would do this work for us. So we looked at the hair in these women, and we found that there was a significant excess of uranium. We looked at all of the elements in the hair. We looked at 52 elements in the hair. And there were various increases in other elements, but none of those elements, calcium, for example, barium, would be associated with congenital disease. But we did find a large excess of uranium. And interestingly, the uranium was slightly enriched and not depleted. So that suggests that the weapons that were being used ordinary uranium or slightly enriched uranium and not depleted uranium anymore. As you might imagine, because there had been such a lot of fuss about depleted uranium in the 90s, that anyone using that weapon, any military operation using that weapon in the 2003 Gulf War and later on, would have used ordinary uranium, because they wouldn't have wanted anyone coming along afterwards and saying, hey, wow, look, you're destroying all the population, and we can measure the depleted uranium in their urine, and you have to go to the International Criminal Court and all this stuff. But we found this excess. So we've tied uranium exposure in the hair through to the congenital malformations, and of course, therefore, also the cancers, you see, and then that ties us into the test veterans' cancers and the test veterans' congenital malformations. And also in the paper that I wrote with my colleagues about the hair, that the hair uranium, that one, we also did a bit of research, and we found that the Gulf War veterans themselves, by then, having children with congenital malformations. Although we haven't done a study of that, certainly other people have. And in the United States, two or three studies have been published in the peer-reviewed literature that show that those people have also got, the U.S. Gulf War veterans also have children with congenital malformations, excess risk of congenital malformations. So, it's really, I know it's an awful story, but it is a story which is completely self-consistent. All of these things tie together, and so it must be so.
And so as far back as we go, the use of uranium, what we find is that its adverse health effects upon the people, of course, are really not exposed to the public, where we come to a point many years later where after all of these tests, and we'll get on to Fukushima, you see what's happened at Maralinga, Fallujah, Kosovo, all of these different places worldwide where the people... The health effects against the people are the real result of using this material, and yet we still have a push for nuclear power worldwide by the military-industrial complex and their associated corporations. But let's talk a little bit about Fukushima, and I've had listeners writing to me over the years saying that we should be covering this, and I have listened to a lot of different information about Fukushima, and as you know, there is a lot of mixed messages going on all around the world, because the reality of it still is not known fully as we see things unfolding. But Chris, talk to us about Fukushima and where it is up to at this point. Is it still bubbling along like a major event still could happen as a result of what's happened there? Talk to us about the state of play in Fukushima and the possible future fallout for, people worldwide, but us here in Australia, connected via the Pacific Ocean. I've seen some of the graphs of the nuclear fallout in the actual oceans, where it's travelling. Speak to us about Fukushima, and really this is the reality of nuclear energy and what can happen with a nuclear power plant, right?
Yes, that's right. Well, it can happen at any nuclear power plant, of course, and almost certainly will. So Fukushima is not the end of this catastrophic accident, if you like to call it that, which started with Chernobyl, or I suppose it started with Winskow, and we've seen a few of them. Now, the baseline, and I think I'll start with the baseline, because there's an awful lot of panic being generated by people on the internet about the health effects of Fukushima globally. And now I'll give you my take on that, is that there's no way that even if Fukushima were to be totally destroyed and all of that material disseminated into the atmosphere, that would not destroy life on Earth. And since it's in the northern hemisphere and there's a separation between the wind systems in the northern and southern hemisphere, it would have a minimal impact on Australia and New Zealand. Of course, it will contaminate the Pacific, and it has contaminated the Pacific, but the Pacific is a very, very large volume of water. And in fact, the contamination of the Pacific from the nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands in 1952 onwards to 1956 produced a much larger amount of fallout, if you like, than could be produced by Fukushima if the entire thing went up. And of course, the big nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands and Christmas Island and in the Northern Hemisphere were so violent that they injected a lot of stuff into the stratosphere, and then it's come down as fallout in rain all over the world. But Fukushima is really quite a local affair. There's no way, in my opinion, that it's possible that there would be a fission-type megaton explosion at Fukushima. Then, I mean, if the worst came to the worst, there might well be a Kishtin-type explosion, a local fission-type explosion. And if that blew everything up in the air, it would all land in the Pacific Ocean and in northern Japan, which would certainly turn northern Japan into Mad Max territory, and people would have to get out of Japan.
Yeah, absolutely.
No question of that. Mm. But it wouldn't affect you in Australia. Mm. It would just be a local affair, because there's an enormous distance between Japan and the United States and the Japan and Australia. And as far as that's concerned, I think you don't have to worry too much about it. It's not like On the Beach, the old Neville Schultz book and the film. It's not going to happen like that. But, of course, having said that, it certainly is going to contaminate the Pacific, the northern Pacific, and small amounts of it will fetch up on the west coast of Australia, and probably larger amounts will turn up in Korea and China. And the main concern about it is from the particles, from the alpha-emitting particles of uranium and plutonium, which will fetch up on the coasts, and then people living near those coasts will certainly ingest those and inhale the particles, which will be put into the atmosphere through a phenomenon called sea to land transfer. So there are big problems associated with this accident for people who are living in Japan, but far less problems in other countries, where I think they should be, rather than concerning themselves about Fukushima, concerning themselves about their own local exposures to radionuclides from power stations which they have in their own countries, particularly in the United States, where there's an awful lot of fallout from nuclear power stations on the west coast of the United States.
Mm. And you know, what I get from listening to you, Chris, and from what I hear worldwide, it's this residual effect that is the big problem with uranium worldwide. In other words, you know, we have atomic bombs going off Hiroshima, Nagasaki. We've got this uranium being used in wars in different locations all around the world. We've got tests taking place. We've got problems like Fukushima and different uranium plants where there's problems that take place. But what you mentioned there is the stratosphere. In other words, this nuclear fallout is going into the atmosphere and then transferring around the world, either via the stratosphere or via the ocean. But there is a residual effect where that material does not go away, right? In other words, it's always resident somewhere, and the build-up of this over time is the biggest problem going into the future as we as humanity continues to experiment and use uranium, future generations are going to reap the results of this demon, as you called it, being, you know, released from the ground. It's going to be the DNA, it's going to be the cell damage in the heart of humanity because of the residual build-up, which will continue the more we use it worldwide, right? But our exposure to it, obviously, is connected to our proximity to these events, but nevertheless, it's still residual at Maralinga and Marshall Islands and wherever these tests have taken place, but this residual effect has the possibility to build up in and adversely affect the health of humanity.
That's right, and the residual effect is not only in the environment, it's in the genome. See, what happens is that someone who's exposed to this and has a child, and the genetic damage that they developed as a result of this exposure then is passed to the child. And it's not just a case of genetic damage. It's what's called what was discovered in the late 90s was a phenomenon called genomic instability, whereby somebody who's exposed to this material actually seems to throw some kind of genetic switch, which then is passed to the child, and then that child has the genetic switch and passes to their child. And this genetic switch causes an increased level of random genetic mutation. Now, I'm an empiricist. Lots and lots of people in this area just talk about, they just wave their arms and they say, oh my goodness, it's all, you know, we're all going to die and so forth. But what I do is I do epidemiology. So I go and look at the numbers of people with cancers and the, if you like, the cancer rate, and particularly the age-specific cancer rate. So in other words, are people getting cancer younger? Are they getting more cancers at any particular age than they would have before? If you listen to the stuff from the cancer registries and from the medical profession, they will say that the increases in cancer, and these are significant. I mean, like 20, 30 years ago, one in five people got cancer, and now it's one in three people get cancer. And the World Health Organization, I learned recently, tell us that in the year 2025, one in two people will get cancer. Now, this is an enormous increase in the age-specific cancer rate. It's not because we're aging, it's because there's an increase in cancer. Now, this is not good. The question is, what causes it? Now, we know, as a result of an enormous amount of research since the 1950s, when there was a so-called war on cancer developed, an enormous amount of money has been spent on cancer research. We know that cancer is an environmental disease. It's a somatic disease caused by environmental exposure to carcinogens. Carcinogens are substances which cause alteration in the genome, alteration in the DNA. So something has happened over the last, 50, 60 years? Something has happened in the environment, the global environment, that has caused this increase in cancer. Now everybody says, oh, well, it's all the chemicals we use. And, of course, the establishment, you know, the government will tell you it's because everybody's going out into the sun too much. And then someone else will say it's because we're smoking too much and so on. But I can tell you from the research I've done, which is an enormous amount of epidemiological research, that the cause of this is the increase in uranium and its fission products in the environment, which are increasing all the time. So long as nuclear power stations continue, they continue to, under license, produce small amounts of waste. Ultimately, of course, they produce large amounts of waste, which has to be buried in the ground. And then, of course, at the same time, as you say, we have nuclear weapon tests, atmospheric nuclear weapons tests. It goes into the stratosphere, comes down in the rain. The strontium-90 and the uranium get into the milk, and the milk is drunk by the children, gets into the children's bones. I mean, none of this is speculation. These measurements have all been made. You can go to many, many publications in the peer-reviewed literature, and you can find increased levels of strontium-90 in children's bone. It's not an argument. So it is the cause of the cancer epidemic. And everybody now has somebody who's died of cancer close to them, some wife or mother or child or dog or canary. The increase in cancer is a consequence of the increased exposure of people to these novel radionuclides, these substances either that never existed on Earth prior to 1945 or were, like I said to the Tanzanian people, were safely locked up in the ground where they couldn't affect their children.
So 1945 is a date and a hinge, a pivotal date upon which you can examine the reality of the cancer rates taking place worldwide. But Chris, you're dealing with a subject here which presses a lot of economic buttons. And could we talk a little bit about the economy as we close our conversation here, and the corporate influence, the push behind the nuclear industry worldwide, and have what sort of pushback have you had in producing and publishing your research? Yeah, you speak all around the world about this subject. It is. Obviously against a lot of economic influences. Could we speak a little about this and your personal experience with pushback from industry?
Well, I don't know about industry, but certainly people have attacked me. In the last 5 years, I've been attacked in the media, I've been attacked on the internet. It's certainly clear to me from having examined these attacks that they're orchestrated, that it's not just individual people doing this. There's an orchestration to these attacks. And the reason for this is quite clear. And of course, these attacks have resulted in total reduction in my funding to zero, really. I mean, I'm talking to you at the moment from a boat. I've had to sell my house and so on. I mean, not that I'm particularly complaining. It's inevitable that people who are threatened, who are making money out of something or another, are going to spend some of their money on trying to bring down the person who might actually stop them from making money. And in my case, I think that it's highly likely that I could stop them from making money. And the fact that I'm talking to you and other people about this subject means that the question of internal radiation and the question of uranium and so on is becoming quite an important one. So yes, I have been brought down by people who've been attacking me for what it is I've been saying. It's quite difficult to get things published, but I do get them published. And I decided to go around the publication system and the scientific system and become, if you like, an activist. So I make these videos on the internet, and I talk directly to people rather than trying to just publish my stuff in journals, which is extremely difficult and
wonderful.
Complicated and tedious.
Wonderful. That's my approach.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful, and we appreciate that. I mean, you mentioned before about the amount of money that it takes, hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases, tens of thousands, to do this research on a particular subject, and that funding, you said basically your funding is dried up. Is that because academic institutions that may fund that, the funding, where does that come from? I guess it comes from a variety of different sources. Is it government? Is it academic institutions, educational institutions that have been lent on by, I guess, big nuclear industry to say that we don't want this this research to go ahead?
I think that is the answer. The governments of the world now operate on the basis of optimizing their income.
Yes, yes.
And the nuclear industry and the military complex fund an enormous amount of research in universities. And so any university that might, for example, take on somebody like me to do research that was antithetical to the picture that nuclear is okay and that these weapons are not dangerous, will be leaned on. And in fact, that has happened. I was a professor at the University of Ulster, and they threw me out because all sorts of nuclear industry puppets wrote to them and said that I was some sort of charlatan and that what I was doing was wrong and so forth. Even though the research that I mean, this is the University of Ulster, the research that I did at the University of Ulster was absolutely critical to the understanding of the exposure to people from these uranium nanoparticles. And it got published. I mean, the research student that I was working with there, originally I was his supervisor, published and got his PhD and so on. And so all of this stuff is out there. But I got kicked out. They said, well, we don't want you here anymore. And then I went to another university in Germany. They picked me up. They called I don't even remember the name of it now. What's it called? It's in Bremen, anyway, Jacobs University in Bremen. And then I worked there for about a year, and then they kicked me out because I published a paper saying that there were all sorts of problems with internal radiation, and the head of department got booted out, and a new head of department came in who was something to do with the German Radiological Protection Agency, and he kicked me out. So so it went on. It goes on like that. Not that I particularly care. You know, I don't need to be associated with the university, but it just gives you a picture of how this sort of thing works.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all about money. Mm. The governments want the money from the nuclear military complex, and they don't want anybody rocking the boat.
Mm. And you know, as I read about your background, and as I read your story, and I've listened to some of your work around the world, I see that you've come to understand that science itself has been captivated by industry, so that what we have is that we have science being presented to the people that is supported by industry. In other words, industry has paid for that science to project the narrative that it is, whether it be about safe nuclear or carbon dioxide is an evil poison or whatever that industry is. But we see behind these this narrative that the media, with academia and inverted commas, you know, science, respected science, which this science has been corrupted worldwide, because the way the world really works and the way governments really work is through financial interests actually helping bail them out of this short-term money problem they've got. They'll be gone in 10 years or 5 years, whatever it is. But this is the way the world really works, Chris. So in closing, let's summarise the push for nuclear worldwide, the way it has been used against the health of humanity, to a large extent depopulating humanity by affecting, you know, the genetic structure of humanity, and the fact that nuclear weapons cannot benefit humanity in any way.
That's right. Well, we live on spaceship Earth, and this is all we've got. And the main problem is that the instruments that tell us what's wrong and what's right have been covered over by people who just want to make money. So there's part of the crew of spaceship Earth who, if you like, are crooks or people who
absolute
criminals. In my opinion, should go to jail. No, the people that we're on spaceship Earth, and the direction that we're going in depends upon instruments that we read on the panel of the spaceship. But the problem is that the panel, the instruments on the panel, have been taken over by a small proportion of people whose object is just to make money and to become powerful. And the problem is that the universities are almost entirely funded now by the nuclear military complex, or by people who are people that we can't believe in, whether it is in the area of genetically modified foods, or in the area of mobile phone radiation, or in the area of ionizing radiation and fallout, or there's a whole range of these things. These scientists are not real scientists. These are people who are puppets and who work for money in order to tell the population, tell the people something which just isn't true. And at the same time, everybody is dying of cancer, or increased rates of illness, and so forth. So it's a really critical problem, which is associated with the economic system. Ultimately, it's the economic system that's the problem, and until we deal with that, we will not get to the basis of this problem about the health effects of radiation or any of these other threats, which they are at the moment entirely invisible to most of the people in the world.
Yeah, well, Dr. Chris Busby, you know, we owe a debt of gratitude to people like you who are have the ability, that have the skills, that have the education and the research ability to be able to track what is taking place in this industry. And I know you have an interest in non-ionizing radiation with cell phones, and maybe we could talk about that in another conversation. But I want to thank you for joining us down here in Australia. Thank you for giving of your time to humanity as a whole for people to truly understand the reality of what the results are of uranium and nuclear fallout worldwide. But Dr. Chris Busby, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate your time and your effort worldwide.
You're very welcome. Thank you for talking to me.